Please join the conversation. I want this space to be a place where people can talk to each other and form a digital community. A group of diverse people whom we can share ideas and visions of how we can come to tackle some of the great issues of the day. If change is going to happen, it's going to come from us and not those who are benefiting from the status quo. I want the space to be a truly democratic place where we can talk about a better future and we can envision and act upon it. It can come in the form of interviews, political commentary, public announcements, call-outs. It can be whatever we want. So if you are involved in important community work, have a great idea, just get in touch with me at stuartrichardson.ca and we can arrange to have a chat and get this out to the world and join the conversation.
I'm very privileged this morning to be joined by Dr. Wayne Roberts. Wayne Roberts is known for his university teaching, media, labor education, industrial relations, and union administration. He is a Canadian food policy analyst and writer. We're very privileged to have you on our program. Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you, Sylvia. Thank you for doing your program.
Now, you have written a book titled Food for City Building, A Guide for Planners. How does food not only inspire, but can guide our way we plan cities?
I was trying to figure out how to make food a city issue. To my mind, if you think of how Indigenous people think of food or how anybody who really understands food thinks about it, it is an all-embracing issue, what some people call a whole-of-government, whole-of-society issue. And governments find it impossible, therefore, to get food. They, you know, what department do you belong in? Is it in public health, or is it in economics, or is it in, you know, garbage, or is it in transportation? And so the biggest problem I had was saying, well, you know what, it isn't in any of them, it's in all of them. And finally, I came across this understanding through an experience I had that food is not an issue in and of itself, only it is a lever. If cities use food properly and treat food properly, it is not just about food or not just about food and health. It can be about how we can advance reconciliation with Aboriginal people, because they have actually a very profound understanding of food and they have food needs that a city can help address. It can help advance multiculturalism on a very broad front. It can help create good jobs for, especially for young people, for starter jobs. It can provide good jobs for newcomers to the city. It can, in my opinion, even solve traffic problems by promoting local food and reducing the number of trucks and cars that are on the road, mainly hauling food. So I developed that concept of that food was a way of building the city. It's therefore something that first of all belonged in the city, and secondly belonged in all departments within the city.
Now, for many of our people, I'm of my ancestry, and we are raised with food as something that's sacred. We have food at our ceremonies, you know, food is part of rituals. Food informs who we are. There are many stories about, you know, being the people of, you know, of corn, right? Being this, how our the seedling that is our life has, you know, so much interconnection to everything we do and how we see affects, you know, what we do in the world. So let's talk a little bit about this idea of wholeness, this idea of whole of government then. How can a government not only see that food, you know, not only connects people, I mean, it helps us understand each other, but also how it can inform the way we understand cities as a living organism?
Sure. Well, that's a great issue. We could go on for a couple of days on that one, but to start with, wholeness is something that is alien to Western thinking. I would say it is native to Indigenous thinking and peasant thinking globally. That is the way you describe it, that food has been part of everything from your rituals to a way to fill your tummy, to a way to be healthy, to a way to be spiritual, to a way to celebrate your connection to nature and all of that. And that became the quote-unquote Western or Anglo-Saxon way of thinking about food. I would say around the 1700s, around the time that England and other European powers saw North America and settled it and saw the rest of the world and conquered it and conquered North America as well. But they displaced that view of wholeness with their segmented understanding. And for them, the North American continent, Canada in particular, was about getting cheap corn into the mouths of cheap workers in the Industrial Revolution in England. And that's the one way they valued food, as a commodity in economics, in other words. And so that is one aspect of food. Of course, it's essential for survival, and you can trade or exchange it. And every group of people have done that since the beginning of time. But the fact, the idea that that's the only thing that makes food tick is a uniquely Anglo-Saxon concept. And it unfortunately, because of the power of English-speaking governments, especially in the United States and United Kingdom, has spread across the world. And consequently, their misunderstanding of what food is has spread across the world with it. And so we're now in a process of an interesting rebuilding of indigenous people, peasant people, and food advocates in Europe who understand there's another way of seeing how we can all configure around the wholeness of food versus the separateness of food.
I was thinking about how, you know, we often hear people talking about the increasing epidemic levels of, you know, diabetes and other illnesses in our society. Mm-hmm. Cancer seems to be constantly alluded to be on the rise. And I wonder, what are your thoughts about the impact that perhaps local gardens, the impact that growing food locally could have, not only on remediating the quality of the food that we eat, but also our ability to, you know, engage in a more holistic way, right, where our whole body is engaged in producing the food mm-hmm. as well as consuming the food, and what benefits that may have for a population?
Great question again. Thank you. Well, I think the reason why urban agriculture is so important, as you mentioned, is not so much because you can produce a heck of a lot of food in the cities. I think about 15% of the world's food is grown in cities now, which is a chunk, but it's not anything close to what cities need. And the world is rapidly urbanizing. The importance of food in cities is not how much food we can create and how much food we can sell. It's how learning about food gives us skills to deal with life in general. One of those skills we need, or one set of them, is about food, nutrition. And I believe that beginning with nursery gardens, which are sponsored in many countries, including Belize in Central America, and many countries in India, they start at a nursery school, kindergarten. Well, the name kindergarten is from the German for child's garden, right? That's what they thought of as the year before grade one, that it should be in a garden. And right through school is, you're not only teaching children how to plant food and look out for it, you're also teaching them how to steward something in general. You're also teaching them how to collaborate with one another and to work together as equals. You're also teaching them how to plan in advance, and you can't just put the seed in today and eat tomorrow. It takes months of work. You're teaching them hundreds of habits that are essential, and you're teaching them the uncertainty of life and the need to really cherish and revere what we're able to take. And you're also teaching them the abundance of life. Because the major problem of food is not scarcity, but superabundance. We don't know what to do with all the food we've grown. That is, ironically, our problem. And so I think that urban agriculture is more a test site for how people can develop new ways of working together so we can take full advantage of the potential of food to transform all our institutions.
What are some of the challenges we face, though? Because here in Vancouver, we have an area that is landlocked. We don't have any more land. We have mountains on one side and the ocean on the other. Mm-hmm. And you see increasingly that agricultural areas are being constantly encroached upon by development. And that doesn't always inspire or create opportunities for children to know even where their food comes from, mm-hmm. Or how to create those spaces. How do we address this issue in ways that can not only ignite the imagination of future generations, but also of the local population who is both striving to create a place to live and a place to thrive?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know what? You can't get much better than British Columbia or immediately to your south in Washington to try to figure out how to go ahead. It's sort of the ideal scenario because you're close to everything, all the forces of nature, mountain, ocean, you know, cold, hot, and the like. And so, first of all, you're at, right literally at the doorstep of one of the world's great fisheries. And all we need to do, if I could say all in quotes, is to treat this fishery properly, and it can supply the population, certainly of British Columbia, with some of the best tasting and healthiest fish in the world. So you're doing very well fishery-wise. Mountain-wise, it's not that's not either a good place to be growing. There's other things that need to grow there, nor a place that's going to be very productive. But one area where cities are in for some massive increase is, you know, that about 1/6 of the space of all cities is flat roofs. That is the roof of most university buildings, high school and elementary school buildings, most office buildings. That's 1/6 of the space, and that can all be a green roof. And that can all be producing food. And unfortunately, many of our foods are now saturated with parking lots, and we can take over the top layers of the parking lots and install what is now called indoor agriculture. And so the air can be purified, and you can grow hydroponically all sorts of food, which as a minor portion of our diet of sprouts and other light fruit and light greens can satisfy a huge portion of sort of the fresh food demand of things that do not last very well beyond 1 or 2 days from when they're picked. Well, you know, when you go to the supermarket and the roof above, they're growing the sprouts that you can buy and eat that night. So there is piles of wasted urban land in every city. That's not used, or spaces of which can be used, beginning with, you know, windowsills, balconies, and the like, all of which can support container gardens. So you've got all of that going for you, plus you have some of the best farmland in the continent immediately south of Vancouver, and as well as, you know, immediately east of you. So, and not to mention Vancouver Island. So you got pretty well everything that is needed. And the most interesting question is, why has that not been started in a serious way? Because the food movement in BC is one of the oldest sections of the food movement in the country. Farm folk, city folk, probably one of the first real food organizations in Canada, came out of the Vancouver area and was actually the inspiration for me becoming a food guy. So I think it's really a rife with opportunity kind of situation for any number of reasons.
When I was a child, my father used to plant our milpa, which is a cornfield. And uh-huh. One thing I learned was that everything worked with everything. You know, we planted corn and then we also planted beans, and the two would help each other grow. And so this idea of diversity, this idea of interdependence is so alive when I see plants growing, when I go into nature. But mm-hmm. I love your idea of bringing nature into our homes. So what would be a small project you could offer our audience that they could get their children started? Something that they could do from their windowsills, from their, mm-hmm. you know.
Okay, great idea. Now, here's my understanding of milpa is that the great contribution of the Mayan people, first to North and South America, where their ideas spread, and secondly to Europe and the rest of the world, is the three crops that were the mainstay of Mayan life, not to mention one of the great, the non-three, like chocolate or cacao and chiclets and a whole bunch of other things that were invented first by indigenous people in Central America, but and the potato, which comes out of South America. They not only developed ways of growing them together, and that is the corn takes a huge amount of nitrogen in order to grow. The beans that grow up along its stalk add nitrogen, pulling it down from the air. And the squash or pumpkins that grow around it on the ground with their huge leaves protect it from erosion. So that they're known as the three sisters. But milpa is that, I believe, plus it is the foraging for wild greens. There were as many as 45 that were in the daily diet of Mayan peoples and are in the daily diet of Mayan peoples who follow those practices to this day. And so not all of these are well-suited to balconies, like corn is a pretty big stalk, but you could definitely do it if you wanted to just see if it could be done. And you should have one in every classroom so teachers could use them as a model for how life works when you know, three's company. You know, it's like the more the merrier, the more diversity is, the better. So there's a good place for that would be at the front of every classroom. But then you also need to have a park nearby where there's an area for people to forage the wild greens that grow there. And probably we talk a lot about food waste. We waste about half of the food that's produced. But when we talk about food waste, we never talk about the fact that we waste all of the what are called weeds. I refer to weeds as plants with a bad public relations. And most of the weeds in there, most of what are classified as weeds in North America are actually healthier than most of the things that are sold as foods, you know, beginning with the dandelion. And there's a whole range of them. So you could do foraging in any park. You could have entire meadows that are beautiful places to walk. And while you're walking, you can pick up a few greens, which is the way women usually were gatherers of wood. And as they'd be gathering their wood and going through the forest, they would be picking up bits of greens, and they'd pick up enough in the bag to add to the milpa at night when they got home. That's sort of how it worked and how women became the founders of both seed savers and of medicine, because they were the ones who found out, this plant does this and this other plant does something different. So there's some really great groups in Vancouver that orient towards young people. And there's other groups like Farm Folk, City Folk, that work with older people, I think, mostly. And you could easily concoct some very doable schemes at a household, school, and neighborhood level.
I loved your enthusiasm, and I can see that this is a passion project for you. What inspires you, not only that, you know, you can ignite, you know, the imagination of children through food, that you can ignite the imagination of governments, you know, to create a whole society, this idea of whole, in a wholeness in our communities, that we are all interconnected, that what we do matters, you know, on even, you know, every little thing we do matters, and that it affects the world. How do you keep yourself nourished and, you know, engage?
Well, to be honest, it takes a lot of work, especially in today's world. But the thing that food offers, in my opinion, is that it is very much a positive project. That's not to say there aren't big problems that have to be criticized and campaigned against, but overwhelmingly, if you are a positive person, there is more than enough for you to do, you know, with your own gardening or with your own community project. Start a garden at your neighborhood school, or if you're at university, there's all sorts of immediate projects. And I think there's a program called Meal Exchange, which is operating at either Simon Fraser or at UBC. You can get the local government to be purchasing local and sustainable foods, which is a very doable project and allows large-scale farmers to engage in it. Go to your local farmer's market. So it's hard to be downcast when there's so many positive things you can be doing. And so I don't care to think too much about Trump. I don't want to go down that rabbit hole of losing every day to following the latest crazy tweets he's doing or any of the other sort of dark populist kinds of things that dominate the headlines in the world's news. The thing about food that I find most inspiring is it provides a basis for individual action, for neighborhood action, and for government action. And if the government doesn't participate, we can still do something significant while we're working for that. So I guess that's what I find. Somewhere around middle age, I said, I want to stop becoming a better protester and demonstrator in that sense, and become a better demonstrator in terms of demonstration projects. And so that shift in my life is, I guess, been continually nourished by the potential for food.
That's beautiful. You are actually a very good example of how not only can we find the opportunities in the crisis, because we could all focus on, you know, the massive fires and erosion of the earth and things like that, and those things we need to pay attention to, and we also at the same time need to find the opportunities to engage, to create, to co-create the world we imagine is possible. Now, you talk about this in one of your conferences that's coming up. You're titling Hole in One, Six Ways Food Can Transform Cities and Institutions. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Okay, well, thanks for plugging that. So you've been talking about the holistic view, and that's what got us going, and that's sort of the theme that I'm starting with. And the sub-theme is six ways that food can transform cities and all institutions. And I've done this in collaboration with Tamara Soma, who's a woman from Indonesia originally, who teaches at Simon Fraser in planning. And we've designed, mainly through her inspiration of great teaching techniques, a day's workshop on Friday, September the 20th from 9:30 in the morning till 3 in the afternoon. And I'll give a talk to give a bit of some of the tools to use in thinking about food. And then we're going to pair up with two unlikely people. You'll be paired with somebody who's most fairly much unlike you, and I'll be paired with someone somewhat unlike me. And we'll spend an hour trying to figure out how food can help each of us understand each other better. And then we'll come back and try to see what magic we can weave in a common workshop with that. So I'm really looking forward to this. It's a concept of a learning journey that Tamara has developed, and it's going to be sort of at the center of this day of workshops.
That's wonderful. You know, among the Navajo people, they say that diversity teaches all how to be ourselves, right? So I'm very excited to see that you're coming to Vancouver. I'm very excited to meet you in person, and I look forward to having this, you know, engaging discussion. Now, as we come to the end of our program, what would be some, you know, inspiration you'd like to leave our audience, or tips or advice on how to tend to the garden, things that they should consider that may be seasonable advice, or?
I guess I would say the starting point of problems with food is to just to see it as a problem. You know, that most often the word most commonly associated with food, if you read, put it in Wordle, and is food problem. And so I've sort of campaigned for most of my career against the idea that there's any food problems. We have created the problems. Food has no problems other than those we've created. And so don't see it as a problem. See it as an opportunity, and for whatever purpose, from here's a chance to turn breakfast into an opportunity to get to know my younger brother better, or to just be alone in my own thoughts, or to practice a gratitude, which I think is part of what we have to give ourselves a minute or two every day to think about, a theme to sort of start the day with, how I can use food to have more fun with my friends. You know, I met some Chinese graduate students the other day who said the thing they couldn't understand about North American graduate students is that around 10 o'clock at a party, they order in food. So whenever we used to have a party around 10 o'clock, we'd all start cooking food. So in other words, we want to move from the consumer status to the producer and the agent and the owner of the activity. And I believe that it needs to become a sense of your own empowerment and agency and place in the world. So that's another big type of opportunity that can be done in a little way daily and in a long way over 365 days a year in a really big way.
That's wonderful. Thank you so much for being with us today. Your book, Food for City Building, A Guide for Planners. How can people access your book? How can people access your work?
Well, I guess the you could connect with me on LinkedIn, and I host about six discussion sites, one with Tamara Soma on food waste, by the way, on LinkedIn, and they're all free. And that's one way, and the other is to look for my book, Food for City Building, on Google, and it's available only electronically, and it's ultra cheap as a consequence. It's like less than $5. So, and it's sort of a memoir of my times and troubles when I managed food issues for the City of Toronto.
That's wonderful. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Yeah, thank you, Sylvia. It's been a great experience. Thank you.
Thank you. Take care.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to Join the Conversation at stuartrichardson.ca. Please feel free to get in touch with me, stuartrichardson.ca, to hear previous shows and to submit your ideas and wonderful community work that you're participating in. And let's get together and join the conversation.